Hi, this is Bob Wells here, and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. This is the show where we hear about people's interests and uncover some fascinating stories at the same time. I hope you enjoy today's show. Hello and welcome to Undercurrent Stories. In today's show, I'm joined by Ollie France. Ollie is an adventurer, expedition leader and speaker who guides teams through the world's wildest places through his company, Wild Edge. Hello and welcome to the show, Ollie.
Hi, Bob. It's a real pleasure to join you. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Great to have you on. So before we talk about your life as an adventurer and Wild Edge, could you just please tell us a little bit about yourself and you know, your life's journey and how you became an adventurer, please?
Absolutely. So I grew up in a northern town, Wigan, which is a sort of a working class town, rugby league town, and grew up playing those traditional sports, football and rugby, and had some young successes. The idea of being an adventurer was never really in my mind, although when I think back, you know, I probably did have some characteristics of an adventurer. I loved being outdoors. I loved just exploring even local fields, forests. And when I came to the stage of making some decisions in my life, it was actually around the age of 16, 17. And I went on this Outward Bound weekend in the Lake District, went rock climbing for the first time, and just absolutely loved it. Loved the adrenaline of it. Loved the feeling of being out in the mountains. And thought, you know what, if there's some way I can find a career in this line of work, I'm sold. And as it happened, I just stumbled upon this degree in outdoor leadership, which is an actual degree, believe it or not. And so went and got a degree in outdoor leadership at the University of Central Lancashire. And there I had the opportunity to learn from greatly experienced instructors in mountaineering, rock climbing, all those things, along with the classroom elements of it. And they, of course, really encouraged us to get out, see the world, go and plan some big expeditions. And so that's exactly what I did throughout my university years, is go off. And I worked in Lebanon for 1 year, one summer. I worked in the States sports coaching the next year, did some voluntary work in Uganda. And it was a combination of the degree and these travels that really kickstarted my love for adventure and set me up for the career.
Well, you've certainly done a lot certainly when you were younger, and carry on doing it. So what, you know, most people have got an idea of what an adventure is, Ollie, but how would you define it?
Adventure to me is, it's almost a very personal journey. It's a very personal experimentation with heading into the unknown. And that really varies depending on who you are, depending on your life experiences. And adventure for some people can be exploring a part of their own village that they've never seen before. Yeah. An adventure for other people can be going off to some faraway place, which is very, very difficult to see. But I think the spirit of adventure is something quite elemental. It is something which exists in us all as humans. And I think, in fact, it is what defines the human race. It is a need to explore. It is a need to understand things which we don't yet understand. You know, you could say that's why we've multiplied and spread our way right across the planet and in all different landscapes, and indeed into space, and have this quest to just explore in many, many ways. And for me, I do it in a very literal sense. Of course, my notion of adventure is being out there in the world and seeing new places. But adventure does exist in everyone, I believe.
Would you say that adventure is almost like getting to the point where you try and scare yourself?
I think that is a huge component, actually. And there's always kind of a proverbial threshold or an abyss or an unknown which you need to step into.
Yeah.
And that for me is where the joy of adventure really comes from. And that can be daunting. There can be an element of fear there, and I understand that. But also I think that's really where the magic happens. That's where even things like the personal growth, that's where there's so much scope for personal growth and development. It lies in these areas of the unknown. And so often taking that daunting step, as scary as it can seem, can be a hugely powerful thing, which just opens our eyes to a world of opportunities.
It's interesting you say that. I've got a friend who recently retired, and he says to sort of you know, motivate himself during the day, and he's got a lot of interest, but what he tends to do is do something where he sort of scares himself a little bit. Just one thing. I don't know what it could be, but just something he could scare himself with.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like that. And I think in the modern world, we're surrounded by comforts. You know, everything is designed to be comfortable. If you think about your home, it's programmed to be the exact temperature you want to be. You can step out into your car, which you can warm up and listen to the music you want to listen to, head off to your comfortable office chair and things like that. And so I understand that if we think about our ancestors, it's always been a struggle to be comfortable. So now actually to go against that and to intentionally seek out discomfort is quite counterintuitive. But I do believe that that's what keeps our pulse going. That's what keeps things exciting. And we need to just have the courage to take that initial step sometimes.
Yeah, it reminds me of Wim Hof and going into cold baths and things.
Indeed.
And that's probably why the cold shower is very popular at the moment, I would say.
I think so. A daily dose of discomfort. It's almost reinforcing that behavior. And that, I think, even something as simple as getting in a cold shower every day, we get used to being in an uncomfortable situation. And that then carries through to other potentially stressful, challenging scenarios in our own lives.
Yeah. I managed 10 minutes this morning.
Wow. I am impressed.
Sorry, 10 seconds.
10 seconds. Yeah. 10 seconds.
Slip well, of the tongue there.
Yeah. That's very good.
So you mentioned some of the countries earlier on that you visited. How many countries in total have you visited only so far?
Well, I'm now up to around 73, 74.
Wow.
And that is, yeah, so that's spread quite widely across Asia and Africa predominantly, and Europe, bits and pieces of other areas too, but lots of Africa and Asia I've had the pleasure of visiting.
Yeah. So tell us about, I'm sure listeners would be really interested to know about some of your most memorable experiences, Ollie. Can you share some of them, please?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many stories here. To come back a little bit in my own timeline, really, I'd mentioned I'd been through university and fell into this job actually selling kitchens in Yorkshire. And it was a job I had no passion for, wasn't particularly good at, and felt the need to escape. And what I actually did in 2015, I quit that job and decided to set off on a big expedition, which was traveling from Hong Kong to Istanbul. So right the way across Asia. The plan was to follow the mountainous spine of Asia and climb at least one mountain visited in every country.
And this was solo, was it, Ollie?
This was solo. It was a solo journey. I would be traveling by any means, so it could be trains, automobiles, hitchhiking, whatever it was. But the physical challenge was to climb at least one mountain in these, you know, tough winter conditions in places like Tibet and China and Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan. And it was a journey which, you know, I got into so quickly, just with this desperate need to get out there and do something I was passionate about, that there were many elements of it which weren't planned to the finest detail as I plan my expeditions now. This was, you know, a really sort of whimsical quest, but I had a start point and I had a destination, and lots of what lay in the middle was very much the unknown, and I just had to be open to all the possibilities that could exist. And so it's difficult to choose some specific moments there, but there are some which really spring to mind. So one in particular, you know, strangely enough, in the space of 4 months that this journey took, I celebrated four different New Year's festivals in different parts of the world, from our own Western New Year to the Chinese New Year, to the Tibetan New Year and the Persian New Year, and happened to be in each country at the right time. It was sort of a happy accident, really. But the most interesting one was the Tibetan New Year, which was really one of the most breathtaking things I've ever experienced. And it was in this small Tibetan town called Langmusi, a very remote part of the Tibetan plateau. And I actually had to sneak past some Chinese police officers who do their best to deter you from seeing these parts of China, and managed to make my way into this village in depths of winter, minus 20, freezing blizzard. And as you approach this village at 4,000 meters, surrounded by mountains, you got just the sound of these, what they call Tibetan longhorns, billowing around the valleys.
Yeah.
You've got people standing on the hilltops throwing these prayer flags into the air. People marching through the town, saying prayers, spinning prayer wheels. It was just an absolutely unbelievable experience. And I was very lucky to be, as far as I saw anyway, the only outsider to actually be present at this festival and document it, and was really warmly welcomed by everybody there. So it was just one of those, even thinking about it now, just sort of sends a shiver down my spine. It was really special.
Was it a bit scary when you were trying to evade the Chinese police?
It was. And I mean, I'd had this sort of cat and mouse game with the Chinese police, actually, even entering China from Laos on this overland journey. They were reluctant to let me in. I was interrogated for an hour. They wanted to know exactly where I was going, what they'd done. They'd spotted in my passport some visa stamps from Central Asia. You had therefore be traveling through what's called Xinjiang province in Western China, which is quite politically sensitive for the Chinese government. They don't particularly want foreigners there. They'd worked out that I was probably going to be there. So I had to talk my way out of that one. And then as I was trying to enter Tibet, had police stopping me at, you know, I couldn't even get a bus into some of these Tibetan towns. And so it was very difficult. But, you know, I treaded the line quite carefully. And ultimately, though, actually, when I was in the Tibetan village, I did get somewhat collared by a few undercover Chinese police officers and kicked out of the town. But fortunately, the festival was over by that point. So yeah. I was happy to comply. It was just for me, rather than feeling worried or scared, I would just found an interesting insight into how things operate in China, and really got a first-hand view into, I suppose, the nature of the Chinese state, really, yeah. Which was just from a geopolitical point of view was very interesting.
Yeah, and I guess you've got a whole load of different experiences. And I forgot to mention, actually, your book, The Trail of the Mountain Folk.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah,
which I should assume tells a lot more stories.
It does indeed. So this is all about this journey across Asia and goes into a heck of a lot more stories about all the weird and wonderful things that happened along the way.
So you mentioned about how you were most welcome in Tibet. You must have met so many different types of people on your travels.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the broadest range of people. And I mean, one of the beauties of what I do, when I started this career, I thought, or what compelled me to do it, was very much about the places I was visiting, the amazing landscapes, the mountains, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But what's compelled me more and more is actually the people that I meet and have the privilege of meeting.
Yes.
Whether that is villagers in Tajikistan or remotest parts of Africa who've barely seen outsiders before and amongst the most humble, welcoming people you could imagine, to some of the people I've guided on my own expeditions, which range from billionaires to ex-CIA officers to terminal cancer patients, really a wide spectrum of people, all of whom have unique, interesting stories to share. And that for me is one of the things which just gives me this continued joy of travel and adventure. It's the opportunity to spend time with people. And anybody who's done travel such as this will know that you form relationships very, very quickly.
Yes.
And so within a couple of days, you know, trekking alongside one another on a mountain trail, you could know more about that person than their colleague who's worked with them for 10 years. It's a really great way of delving into somebody's lives. And, you know, you may never see them again.
No.
You keep in touch with some people, sure, but sometimes it's just a glimpse into people's lives, and probably similar to your experience on this podcast, it can be a very, very powerful way of really understanding humans, human nature, motivations, fears, dreams, all of these things. And that really does fascinate me.
It's fascinating. And I too regard it as a privilege.
Mm.
Yeah. You mentioned there about your expedition. This is Wild Edge, your company. Can you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Yes, absolutely. So I started this company just about 18 months ago, and this was the culmination of really over a decade spent completing my own solo challenges, working freelance for other companies, running lots of expeditions, lots of ambitious trips. And I wanted to create a company where I could guide people on their own adventures. I could have, I could be the expedition leader. I could organize it. I can work with groups. And now I work with lots of corporate charity groups who want to elevate their teams, take them to the next level. And I've found that completing these challenging, adventurous experiences is an extremely powerful way of uniting a team and really taking them to the next level. So I'm interested in that dimension. And it's also an opportunity to really share my passion and my love for the world with other people. You know, this is what I love to do. And I can almost experience this through their eyes too. That brings me a lot of joy. So the company's Wild Edge, and I have lots of big, bold plans for the future, but always excited to hear from adventurous people looking to have their own experience.
And is it limited by age that people can go on these adventures, or is it any age?
Really, really not. I mean, when I think back across some of my expeditions, I've had people from the age of 14, 15, right up to 84. Of course, some of them you need to be physically fit, and there I can work with people. You know, I even offer training programs, things like that, for some of my expeditions. But no, it's very open. If people have an appetite for adventure, they're willing to perhaps work on the fitness for some of these expeditions. It's really open to everybody.
And are the expeditions all overseas, or do you do any in the UK?
So I do most of my expeditions overseas, really, although I run some training courses, training programs here in the UK, and it can be a good stepping stone, actually, for those who just want that first taste of being out in a mountain environment, and then, you know, can build the stepping stones from there to a bigger overseas expedition. So this is certainly in my sights to do more in the UK. I'm just personally so appealed to being out there overseas. But yes, there's certainly intent to do that.
And how many people do you normally take on an expedition? And do you have somebody else leading as well?
So I normally take anywhere between sort of 5 and 15, 16 people, really depending on the expedition. And yes, one thing I'm very careful to do and is a critically important part of any expedition for me is to have a really good local contact. The way in which they're involved varies depending on the expedition. So sometimes I might hire a local guide who has expert knowledge of a particular mountain. I might hire porters to assist us with our kit, or cooks, or people to help with local logistics. There's even some destinations, you know, I worked in places like Iraq and Syria, Somalia, where we'd need to hire armed security to be with us to support our journey.
Sorry, did you just mention Iraq and Syria there?
I did indeed,
So you take people to Iraq and Syria?
I have done, yeah.
Wow.
Yes. So I was in Syria last year, and we spent around 9 days. I was guiding the team through the country alongside our local fixer.
Yeah.
And that was a truly fascinating journey. And we ended up in lots of the places which people will have heard about in the news: Aleppo, Palmyra, Homs, Damascus. And actually walking through Aleppo, for example, we were speaking to local shopkeepers who told us we were the first tourists they'd seen in a decade. So this was really on the cutting edge of what it's possible to do with a tourist group, you know, right at the limit.
I mean, talking about going to somewhere like Syria. I mean, we see the headlines in the news which show dramatic pictures of people being bombed and all the rest of it. Mm. When you actually meet the people, I mean, how are they? They must be really war-torn and tired and fatigued. How do they seem?
Well, you know, one of the things which has fascinated me traveling to places like Syria is just the sheer joy and happiness that I've encountered in certain countries, which you could never anticipate, you know, looking from the outside in. And, you know, to create one particular scene for you, I remember walking through Aleppo, this town which you drive through there and you can drive for mile upon mile, and every building is completely destroyed all around you. And we arrived in this small square, and there was a group of young boys playing football and just having the time of their lives, you know, laughing, joking, inviting us to play football, debating which footballers were the best players in the world. And it was just a really joyful experience. And actually, it made me think a lot about the power of perspectives. And of course, for the outsider's point of view, this was indeed a war-torn, you know, decimated city. But from the eyes of these children, this was a brilliant place where they could hang out with their friends. And actually, you know, I've encountered far more people in places like this who are just going about ordinary lives. They're starting businesses, starting families, you know, getting together with friends, having good times. And they can be amongst the most resolute, friendly, welcoming people that I've ever met, which is really counterintuitive. And I suppose when they've been through experiences like that, it's about finding the joy in the simple moments.
Yeah.
And that's something I think which is a powerful thing you can take home with you as well.
So rather than being in a sort of transition period for themselves of sort of, you know, trying to get out of the place, they're actually there embracing it and making the best that they can with what they've got.
Those who are still there, yeah. I mean, Syria, heck of a lot of people. I don't know the exact statistics, but millions upon millions of Syrians have left the country.
Yeah.
This war, of course, started around 12, 13 years ago now. So those who remain, it's unlikely now that they'll be looking to leave. And they're now starting the rebuilding process. And this is what we witnessed, actually, is in a very literal way, actually, rebuilding all of these majestic ancient buildings. And of course, this part of the world, it's what's known as the cradle of civilization. It's got some of the oldest, greatest cities on earth, which many of which were sadly destroyed. And so the rebuilding is taking place. People are starting to try and get their businesses up and running again. For sure, the country's still got a lot of difficulties. There are still areas where you would avoid, and there is sort of isolated areas of fighting. But yeah, for some of them, they're just trying to rebuild their lives against the odds.
It's amazing. So in terms of the trips that you've got planned with Wild Edge this year, what sort of countries are you going to?
So this year, actually, not so many super dangerous countries. So the next one will be actually Kilimanjaro. And this is a trek which I've now completed a few times. And for some years, I was never that interested in Kilimanjaro. I thought, oh, it might be too overrun, it might be too crowded. But having been there several times, it is a really incredible experience. The local guys there are exceptional. We work with a really good team there. And Kilimanjaro is, of course, the highest mountain in Africa. So it's a great bucket list adventure, and it really is a memorable trip. So I'm excited to be heading back there in September. I'm also planning a small group trip to Aconcagua, which is the highest mountain in South America, later in this year, around December time, and then looking ahead to following year as well.
And for any listeners that are interested in any of these trips, are there still places available, Ollie?
There are indeed, yes. Yeah, so thanks for mentioning that, Bob. And if you are interested, please head on to the Wild Edge website, which is wildedge.co. And I'd be always glad to talk you through it and have a phone call and get you sorted for this adventure.
And how long are the trips? How many days would somebody need to take off?
So a Kilimanjaro trek is 9 days from the UK back to the UK. So we plan it around the weekend so that people would actually only need to take off 5 days if they were just doing the trek itself. Although some people do stay out there, it's a great opportunity to go and do a safari afterwards or go.
Oh, so you can mix and match it and have a little holiday at the end.
Absolutely, yeah. Lots of people do that.
Now, obviously, we got to know each other fairly recently through LinkedIn, and I noticed that you're doing quite a few speeches, sort of inspirational speeches. And one of the things that comes up a lot is the fact that when you take people to these remote and harsh environments, and I also speak for your own experience as well, it seems to unlock confidence. Can you just tell us about that, please?
Yeah, well, I think this idea of it's really resilience, you know, resilience and confidence. We can sort of look at those two in combination. And for me, resilience is something which we need to extend ourselves. We talked about the unknown and heading out of our comfort zones. We need to extend ourselves into these areas really to unlock this resilience. You know, I was thinking, you're not going to build resilience sitting at home watching television. It's just not going to happen. So we build resilience by going out there, pushing ourselves, in whatever way that is. It doesn't need to be a physical challenge. But for me, when it comes to expeditions, for sure, no matter how prepared somebody is, there's always going to be a moment where they look at the situation they're in and just seriously question their life's choices and say, why did I sign up for this challenge? You know, I've seen it countless times, and I've seen it amongst the fittest, the most prepared people. You know, so often I've worked with people who are sometimes going through their lowest ebb and they feel they cannot carry on. They're suffering unimaginably, that all they want to do is get off this mountain, stop this trek. But the thing that I always say is, resilience, really, it's not about what happens to us. It's a lot more about what happens within us. And it's not worrying about the stresses and strains of the outside world, but it's much more about battling that little voice in our heads which tells us to stop. And I often compare resilience, or the idea of resilience, to the weather, in that, you know, anyone in Britain knows we cannot control the weather. And sometimes it's bright and sunny, sometimes it's cloudy, sometimes there are dark thunderstorms. The same thing happens in our minds. These thoughts are going to come into our minds no matter what we're going through. And certainly on an expedition where you are going through real hardships and real unknowns. But what we need to continue reminding ourselves of is that these storms in our mind will eventually pass. And all we need to do is just keep on going. And that's always my message within these expeditions. It is, yeah, it's hard, it's tough. You know, we've had a rubbish day, but things will improve. Things will get better. We just need to keep on going.
So what you're saying is, if you're on one of these expeditions and you see somebody faltering, you'll have a little chat with them.
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's a huge part of my role as the expedition leader. It's keeping tabs on everybody within the team. And I know I always place myself back in the shoes of my first expedition overseas. And I remember how it felt. I remember the uncertainties. And I remember the sense of discomfort at times. And it can be difficult to talk about that. You know, you're talking about full-grown men and women here, who many of whom run successful businesses or have great careers and things like that. And so admitting that you're struggling can be very difficult. But one of the first things I always say when I meet my teams is, you know, my number one priority on this expedition is your safety.
Yeah.
Getting to the mountain, that's number two. And the order of those priorities is very, very important.
Yeah.
And what's going to assist in that is you being open with me. You know, I can only do my job to my best abilities if you're being open.
And I guess that would mean sort of asking people to park their ego just before they leave.
100%. And in fact, I say those very words quite often. Yeah, I say, you know, the mountain is no place for egos. So
no. So
they need to be left at the bottom of the mountain.
So I guess what you're saying is, and you obviously talk about this through your talks, and you see people building their resilience and confidence as they go through. What it means is, at the end of it, this is how I would put it, at the end of it, when they've completed the expedition, because they've gone through those storms and they've managed to cope with them, when they get back to everyday life, they can almost use that experience in their everyday lives. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. And that's what I see all the time. It's, you know, you recalibrate what it is that you feel you're capable of. And that's a very powerful thing. And suddenly, you know, people's eyes are open to their own possibilities. And so often the limitations that we see are very much self-imposed. And we just need to be nudged and pushed and test the waters a little bit to realize that actually our limitations are way further than we may ever have anticipated.
It's interesting, isn't it, that? Because when you think about it, if say we've got any listeners that have been on various holidays, I wonder what holidays leave the most impression with them, whether it's just sitting on the beach for a week, reading a book and drinking, or whether they've had a few, you know, trials and tribulations on another holiday. And that's the one that they tell the stories of and they remember.
Oh, for sure. And it's certainly the case with me. So often the best stories are from the toughest times, and those can produce the best learning lessons as well.
Yeah.
Hindsight can be quite generous. But for sure, you know, some of the best sort of dinner table or after dinner talking stories that I've got have all come from the hard times.
Yeah. And just sort of rewinding a bit back to your own experiences, what was the hardest challenge you ever had? The most dangerous time you ever had? Can you just tell listeners about some of those or one episode?
Yeah, I mean, once again, there are quite a few avenues I could go down here. you know, to touch on a couple before I delve into one, I was caught in a 6.9 magnitude earthquake in Indonesia. That was quite a harrowing experience. Wow. I had a gun pulled on me in Iraq, lost in a landmine jungle in Laos. I was...
Sorry, lost in a landmine jungle?
Yes.
On your own, treading carefully,
with a friend, yeah, carefully. We lost the track. It was a very heavily landmined area, very poor track, trying to climb a mountain which hadn't been climbed in very many years. And we just had to be extremely careful and try and find our way out of that. That was quite a scary moment many years ago.
Yeah.
But I mean, probably the most extreme example. I've also fought illnesses and actually had came down with meningitis after a trip to Somalia, spent a week in hospital, got extremely ill. That was very physically challenging. But probably the situation where I felt out of control the most was in Uzbekistan, and I was essentially detained as a drug trafficker after they found some...
Sorry, just for listening, Uzbekistan borders on...
So Uzbekistan is in, Central Asia.
Afghanistan.
Yes, it's north of Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah.
You've got Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, all surrounding Uzbekistan. So it's a landlocked country.
Yes.
And... at the time I was visiting there, this was back in 2016 when I was traveling across Asia, it was a brutally strict authoritarian regime, police state. And so I'd been warned just to be careful. And so as I was crossing into Uzbekistan, very late at night from Tajikistan over a land border, all of my possessions were taken off me. My rucksack was checked. All of my phone, laptop, electronic items, they were checked through. They looked through the files, the photographs, everything, full body search. And what they found ultimately was some cocodamol tablets, which unbeknown to me at that time, contained codeine, which is derived from heroin, which happens to be, 95% of heroin comes from Afghanistan to the south. So it's a very hot drugs trafficking route. And so they're very, very hot on drugs. And in Uzbekistan, that means cocodamol is classed as an illegal narcotic. This is a prescription drug which you can get here in the UK, no problem at all.
Yeah.
And there I was suddenly detained as a drug trafficker in one of the world's most authoritarian regimes. And so that was a moment where suddenly I was just out of control, really. I had very little control over what was going to happen next. And of course, all kinds of worries were coming through my mind of being locked up in this police state for however long. And it turned into quite the ordeal, really. I was interrogated, first of all, for 4 hours before they said, we want you to sign these papers. They presented me with these papers, all written in Russian. I had no idea what they were saying. And they said to me, okay, it's going to be better for you if you can sign these papers. And of course, I was not going to sign these papers. No. I had no idea what they said.
No.
And so I said, look, I want to phone the British Embassy. I'm sure they can help. And they said, okay, you spend the night here. You can call them in the morning. And so I spent the night. They said, you've got 3 minutes, one phone call. There you go. So called the British Embassy. This was a Friday, late March 2016, and got a automatic voice message saying, sorry, it's Easter Friday. We're going to be closed until next Tuesday. Goodbye. And that was me back to square one, no communications with the outside world.
No.
And then I was taken down to the Afghan border, actually, to a city called Termez. And there they took blood samples, urine samples, further interrogations, to see if I still had this drug in my system, so-called drug, and ultimately assigned me with a lawyer and gave me a choice of either 30 days in jail or $500 fine. And I opted for the fine.
Yeah,
it would have been simple had I had the cash.
Yes.
But I didn't have the hard currency. I had my Visa and MasterCard, but unfortunately they're not accepted in Uzbekistan. So I was unable to get my hands on this cash I needed to pay my way out of jail. And essentially what I needed to do was allow them to for me to make another phone call back home, got my dad to Western Union, transfer it, called him at 5 a.m. on a Saturday morning, explained the situation. They were worried. And the story goes on and on. And eventually I ended up with a bag full of cash, literally, because the Uzbek currency, the denominations, the biggest one is worth about 20p, so $500 worth is literally a bag full of cash, walking into what turned out to be an ex-KGB compound on the edge of Termez to pay my way out of jail.
Yeah.
And was consequently followed around the country by spying policemen, and made it out of there about a week later. But it was a crazy experience.
It's like something out of a film, Ollie.
It felt like it.
Yeah.
It really felt like it.
And is that in your book?
It is indeed, detail.
Sounds interesting. Well, we'll definitely put the link to the book on the show notes there for people, if anybody's interested. So I like the sound of this, and particularly the adventure, you know, going away with a group of people for 10 days sounds great. But I guess there must be the odd listener who, whilst they'd like to do something like that with their family life, perhaps they're bringing up young children, they've got a big career, they can't really take too much time off. What can they do, would you suggest, Ollie, that sort of brings the same time, unlocks that sort of confidence if they feel that they could benefit from something like that? Are there any suggestions that you could make to them?
Yeah, so quite a new thing, and this kind of came about through the pandemic, is this idea of micro-adventures. And this is the idea of almost making the most of what they call your 5 to 9. So not your 9 to 5, your 5 to 9. It's that time outside of the office, you know, for many people who are working conventional jobs. And it's really, what can we do that is in our immediate area to go and explore, to go and push ourselves? And that might be, you know, taking a train up to the Lake District after work, going camping and getting back into the office in time for the start of the next day. So there are many ways we can challenge ourselves on a smaller scale. And I think, as I said right at the start, we don't need to get caught up in the notion that adventure needs to be exploring the world's farthest flung places. Adventure actually can lie on our doorstep. And in fact, for me, I love exploring my local area, seeing new places that I've not been before, spend a lot of time in Scotland, in the Lake District, in North Wales. And so it really is on our doorstep. Sometimes, you know, we might need to pick up a guidebook, get a few suggestions, but it's putting the time aside to go and have these experiences. And as a general rule, you know, what I often say is there's no such thing as perfect timing. So right. Often we put these things off until some future date, which we think might be the perfect time. But really, we just need to make a start, at however small that initial step might be.
Good advice there. Good advice. What do you see as the ultimate challenge for yourself, Ollie?
Well, I'm currently planning a really big expedition project, actually, which I've been working towards for several years now. And this is the idea of essentially traveling from the lowest point in each continent to the highest. So all 7 continents. And these would be much more solo journeys than sort of group expeditions.
Yeah.
But it would be, taking all of the 7 continents, lowest to highest point. So of course, that's climbing the 7 highest mountains in each of the 7 continents. And this would be a multi-year project across many, many different terrains and landscapes. Would test me in very, very difficult ways, but it would be actually a world first journey if I can complete it.
I was going to mention there, it'd have to be Guinness Book of Records stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. This would be, it's never been done before. So no. It's really on the limits of what's possible. And in fact, it's taken many, many years of research to really understand the intricacies of each stage of the journey, and now believe that it is possible. And so the next thing is to of course start.
So in Europe, what would they be? What would be the 2 locations?
So Europe, the lowest point is the Caspian Sea, which is right on the edge of Europe. We often don't think of that as Europe, but of course, half of Russia is in Europe, separated at the Ural Mountains. So that place is the Caspian Sea in Europe. And then the highest point is Mount Elbrus, which is in Russia, near in the Caucasus mountain chain, which separates Russia from Georgia and Azerbaijan. So that one in particular is tricky right now, of course, with the situation in Russia and Ukraine.
Of course. So
in fact, geopolitically, it's probably the trickiest, although physically not that difficult, because the Caspian and Elbrus are very close together. Some journeys would involve 4,000-mile cycle rides through multiple countries. Some would involve boats or skis and various modes of transport. But the idea is to do them all fully human powered with no cars, no other means of transport.
So Antarctica, that'd be an interesting one.
It will indeed, yes. And that will involve starting from the edge of the Antarctic landmass and then working my way to Mount Vinson, which is over 4,000 metres. Of course, freezing towering mountain out there, yeah, in Antarctica, very remote, logistically difficult. It does get climbed, but the element that I'm trying to introduce will complicate things, to say the least. So that will all make things, yeah, much more challenging.
So I guess the... You'd bring your skis for that, but actually set off from the highest part down to the lowest part, and you could ski there. Is that right?
Well, that does sound a good idea, actually. Maybe I need to swap the challenge around for that one.
And what size do you have on any nautical adventures, Ollie?
So I've not done too many, actually. I mean, probably the wildest nautical experience so far was heading off on a boat off the Somalian coast, which is, of course, famous for its pirates. Unfortunately, we didn't encounter any. Right now, it's a very common challenge to row across the oceans. So yep, the Atlantic, even the Pacific at a more extreme level. It is something I would like to try. In fact, when I think about the things that scare me, you know, the thought of the deep ocean is something which I've always found a little intimidating. So that would be a very different challenge. Lots of my challenges have been on land. So, yeah, maybe one day I'll pluck up my own courage and do a big nautical adventure too.
One for the future.
Yeah.
And, for you know, if there's any listeners out there who really do fancy the idea of doing something like you've done, not so much with the Wild Edge at the moment, but more on the solo adventure, what advice would you give them?
Well, the first piece is going back to that just start. It's it doesn't need to be the grandest plan at the beginning. But I think another element is if you really want to push things, you want to take things to the next level, is don't be hesitant in taking the time to get some expert input, some expert guidance. If you are thinking of going into a remote area, use the resources available. And I've certainly in my earlier years fallen into the trap of going out and thinking I could do it all myself.
Yeah.
And when in fact, you know, that's not the case in a remote area. You need to have some systems in place and some local expertise. It is there. And we need to tap into that. So that would be a big piece of advice, is find a good local contact. If you want to improve certain skills, find people who can teach you. You know, there are lots of great instructors in all disciplines right across the UK and elsewhere. And then just think about your plan. So have a robust plan. Think about your communications, how you're going to contact the outside world, your safety. Have some risk assessments, some what they call escape routes. If you're doing a remote trek, for example, think about other possibilities, how you could change the route if things turn bad. Think about your kit. I mean, there's many, many layers to it, but the more you're pushing things, the more detailed the planning needs to be. But of course, the critical thing is taking that first step and doing it.
Yeah, and I guess if you're a bit of an armchair adventurer and you read lots of books, but you are beginning to think about something like that, maybe it could start, maybe just get yourself a tent and learn how to put it up and do a little bit of camping not far from home.
Of course. And that's exactly how I started.
Yeah.
It was, you know, I remember my very first mountain that I did on my own. We were so clueless. We were going up in ski jackets and boiling hot. And we even carried little chairs up there because we thought we'd need to have somewhere to sit down. You know, we were totally encumbered with all of this gear that we didn't even make it to the top in bad weather. And, you know, it's okay to have those experiences. It's all part of the stepping stones.
Yeah. I think I probably know the answer to this because you've answered a lot of it. Have you got any other projects coming up?
So I'm really enjoying speaking to lots of corporate groups right now and sharing stories of resilience and confidence and leadership that I've learned over the last decade on these expeditions. So these are, yeah, I see these as really interesting projects. And of course, working with more and more corporate groups who want to undertake big team building exercises in adventurous places, alongside this, my main focus is the Seven Continents challenge, which I will be properly launching in due course and making a start on this year. Very, very excited to get underway with that.
Where can people find out more about your work, Ollie?
So my website is wildedge.co or .co, and I'm very active on Instagram, on LinkedIn at Ollie_France on Instagram, and you'll find me at Ollie France on LinkedIn. So always great to connect with new people, especially if you're an adventurous spirit, and particularly if you'd like to go and have your own expedition.
Well, it's been a really interesting conversation, Ollie. I've certainly found it inspirational. I'm sure listeners will do too. My guest today has been Ollie France. Ollie is an adventurer, expedition leader and speaker, and founder of Wild Edge. He's also the author of The Trail of the Mountain Folk, a link of which can be found on the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Ollie.
Thanks, Bob. It's been a real pleasure. Really enjoyed the conversation.
You have been listening to Undercurrent Stories. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please feel free to share the show link to your friends and family. And if you have 60 seconds, I will be most grateful if you would please rate and review. To hear more episodes, please subscribe to the show and visit undercurrentstories.com. If you leave your email in the link, we will notify you as soon as new episodes are released. Also, check out our social media links, details of which can be found on the show notes. Until next time, this is Bob Wells wishing you all the very best.